This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Investors, they are, perhaps rightly, worried about this spike that we're seeing across the country in coronavirus cases, especially in the Sun Belt. This is not a disease we know that summer is going to just sort of take away from us. The numbers are scary. John Tozzi is a healthcare reporter for Bloomberg. He joins us on the phone from Queens. And, you know, John, I grew up in Houston, and so I look at what's going on in that city. I look at Texas, and it's really troubling and a little bit scary. Help us understand where we are, because 2 months after, almost 3 months after we were facing this in New York City, we're back to counting beds again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really concerning situation, as you said, and you know, not just in Texas, but in a number of states. Arizona, California have recently set records for new cases, and you know, we are seeing a rise in hospitalizations as well. So, you know, sometimes new cases are just an indication of more testing, but I think there are an increasing number of positive tests. And an increasing number of hospitalizations. And, you know, the concern, I think, everywhere is to avoid getting to a point where hospital systems are, you know, are overwhelmed, that they have, you know, that they don't have enough beds to treat the patients they have coming in.
Right. So much so that as you, you know, put in your story that late yesterday, the Texas Children's Hospital System in Houston began accepting adult COVID-19 patients because of a surging demand. I do wonder, John, in your reporting, have those states that are now dealing with surges in cases and increasing hospitalization, have they learned anything? Are they better prepared than we were potentially here on the East Coast, you know, where it just kind of, I think, safe to say, no one expected it, you know, to shoot up as much as it did. And I think a lot of people were caught not, you know, unprepared. So I just wonder, are hospital systems across the country better prepared now?
I think there are a lot of variables in play. I think in some ways, yes. You know, everybody has now had some time to sort of see this coming and, you know, to begin stockpiling personal protective equipment, you know, and medicines, you know, and to kind of really look carefully at their plans around how they are going to create surge capacity if they need to, you know, but there are some other factors that, you know, pull in the other direction. In New York in March and early April, basically everything stopped. People were not getting medical care for, you know, non-emergent issues other than COVID. A lot of scheduled care was just canceled for weeks in order to give the hospitals capacity to, you know, to treat the COVID surge. In most of the country, elective surgeries have resumed, and hospitals are treating patients, you know, who couldn't put up care indefinitely for, you know, really serious issues in some cases. So, you know, they're balancing that as well, along with, you know, the kind of rising number of coronavirus cases.
So, being a little bit parochial here, how much do we need to worry in the tri-state area, which is starting to get back to work, where we, it feels like, have been assured along the way that New York and states surrounding would be ready if there was a second wave? What have we learned? What do we need to be worried about, especially because of what happened here before?
Well, I think what the epidemiologists will tell you is that the potential for more spread of the virus exists everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Because most of the population is still susceptible. So even though, you know, in New York, the number of people testing positive is very low now, and it feels much safer than it did certainly a couple months ago, You know, there's nothing to say that, you know, we won't be in a similar situation to what we're seeing in Texas and Arizona again at some point down the line. And I think, you know, hospital systems everywhere are, you know, considering, you know, what they have to do to prepare for that kind of situation. And, you know, one of the messages I think we're hearing from health officials,
No, you know what I was just going to say, just to wrap up, is I love the way you wrap up your story. And there's a quote, I believe, from one physician who talks about that even if the health system is as prepared as we can be, if we see the degree of COVID cases and hospitalizations and it keeps growing exponentially, this doctor says, I don't know if even the best preparation in the world would be enough. And it just is once again, you know, Jason, a repeat of, you know, you can prepare and prepare, but when those numbers go off the chart, it's really tough to keep up. And that's potentially what we could see again. John, thank you so much. Really appreciate the story and your reporting. John Tazi, healthcare reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone in Queens, New York. And Jason, listen, you know, here we are once again. Check out Most Read on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Yeah.
There are, you know, for a while, the virus updates was trending much lower in terms of what everybody was reading on the terminal. It's back up again.
We've been here before. We've seen this movie, and I think we didn't like it the first time, and we like it even less this time. So we're going to keep a close eye on this for sure. Eager to get some time later with the dean of the Stanford Medical School and get his perspective on what they're seeing from a medical perspective. We have leaned heavily on doctors and deans like him to give us a reality check in terms of preparation, but also you know, some prescriptive advice on what we should be thinking about when it comes to work and life and all of it.
I have advice for you, Jason.
Wear a mask.
Yeah, and social distancing.
Yeah.
I'm just going to put it out there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry for the sarcasm. Large family, grew up on sarcasm. All right, folks.
I'm not even sure it's sarcastic at this point. It's just direct.
You're absolutely right.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, today was day three of Bloomberg Global
Amazing Invest event.
Wrapping it up, actually, right now, I believe they're wrapping it up here in the U.S. So it went around the world. It was in Asia, Middle East, Europe, and the United States, obviously. And during the European portion this morning, I got to catch up with Bruce Flatt. You've met him. We've spent some time with him out in L.A. and elsewhere. He's based in New York. He was in London. He's got a global portfolio. They are a massive real estate investor.
Huge.
Massive. Real estate, infrastructure, renewables. We talked about all of it. Check out a portion of this conversation.
I would just say that, leave aside the health impact of everything. The only thing constant in life is change. And we've witnessed from all across the world the closing down of offices and the opening up of offices. And we're virtually opened up all of our offices globally, and we're back up at some offices 100%. In London here, we're probably 65, 70%. New York, we're 25 or 30. So the numbers have been going back up, and it's taken us 3 months. It's been stressful for a lot of people, but, the bottom line, this will pass, and this is the crisis of the day, but we'll look back at it. And some small things are going to change, but a lot are going back to where they were. And we'll have another crisis in the future, I'm sure, that'll be just as bad as this one when you're in the middle of it.
So what are those small things that have changed? Because you have a window, literally and figuratively, into how we work. We spend so much of our time at the office. We spend time shopping. You also have a window into that. What are the things that you see that will change in the short to midterm that we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so for offices, once we shut down office buildings around the world and people went home, we started thinking, this is 3 months ago, we started thinking about what is it that we need to do to get those offices back open. And that has included all of the things that you have seen if you're in an office today, or you will see when you shortly go back, which is, there's more distancing. Elevators are have spacing out. There's more cleaning. Our air is better than what you're breathing in your house because we are taking particles out of the air that we never took out before. So all of those things are happening in office buildings today, and they are going to be some of the safest places in the world to be in the future. In retail, there's no doubt there was this trend that was going on, and the trend was online and good retail were moving together, and retailers were using them together as one space to deliver goods to customers. And that's going to be accelerated, there's no doubt, with curbside pickup probably increasing and other things happening. The trends that were happening are going to continue to increase, some of them exponentially as we come out of this.
And it's safe to say, and I know that this is your business, but you're still long office as a way of working. You've talked several times over the past few weeks about the power of people being together and those sorts of things. I think we're seeing that manifest even in our social lives. Just help me understand that a little bit.
So here's what I would say. Our view is that office space, after talking to virtually every company that we lease space to, that they're bringing their people back. The only reason some are saying we're actually not bringing back everyone right now is they don't have enough space to be able to have social distancing while that's important to bring everyone back. So they may be bringing back 50% of the people because of that. But eventually they're going to bring them all back. And I guess the point I would make, and I think this is in our company, but it's in other companies we talk to, the office is about the social interaction of people. It creates a culture in a business. The spontaneity and the collaboration that comes from an office is incredibly important to a business. And you can't create that by video conference. You can maintain it for a while, and that's what we've all done for a little while. But you really can't do that over the longer term. So offices are going to be incredibly important, as they were before. And in fact, today, Jason, we're actually leasing greater amounts of space to people than they had before because they want to accommodate all our people and get them back quickly. And so they're increasing their footprints versus taking less.
That's fascinating.
Right.
But it can go either way, right, Jason? People can either, you know, reduce their footprint and either have people out in the suburbs or working from home, or they can increase their footprint in the big cities to give everybody more space so that they feel comfortable. So that's,
yeah.
And I've heard the death of major cities. How many times? How many times have we heard it?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen. I just think we're going to have to figure out new ways.
I think cities are going to change. I think you're going to have,
True.
You know, I was talking to some people on the heels of this conversation, you know, because lots of people wanted to talk about what Bruce had to say. And, you know, it's interesting. I think we're going to be living in a hybrid world. You know, I just think about my experience this week alone,
yeah.
You know, where it's
right.
Like, I spent a couple days in the office. Here I am. I'm doing the show, you know, with you. I did the show with you yesterday in a totally different location.
Right.
You know, obviously different people's jobs require different things at different times. And, you know, I do think, though, the structure of cities could change. You know, one of the things we talked about later on in the conversation prompted by an audience question was, does the architecture and design of cities change? And this is something you've talked about, which is, do we move to a place where actually we want a little more space, so we need more walkable spaces, we need more space for outdoor dining, and so does that change the way cities look and feel? I think it's possible.
It's so funny. For the first time, I went into our local supermarket just recently, which has been like was kind of a big thing for me because we've just stayed away, and it was, I got to say, it was a clean place to begin with. It was cleaner. It was really organized. There was more space. Like the aisles were open, and there were, you could only walk one way down, and I have to say, to some extent, maybe we need to rethink some of the way things are built and on a grander scale cities. I got to say, the city has gotten crowded. There's a lot more cars because of Uber and Lyft. And I'm not saying those need to go away because I think they have provided great services. But I think we need to think about, it's a walking city and it's become much more difficult to do that. So let's figure that out.
Yeah, I think in order to do that, though, you got to figure out public transportation. And I have yet to take public transportation, so I can't judge it fully. But the reality is that has to be clean. I mean, it has to be clean beyond clean. And by all accounts, the MTA has done a great job. But the thing we have to worry about is large groups of people.
Right. Listen, and it's needed to be cleaner than what it's been
Fair point.
Okay, I'm just going to put that out. And I know it's really tough when you think about, my husband and I were talking about the numbers that ride it on a daily basis when everything's normal. It's unbelievable, but it can be better.
Yeah.
And I think we need to figure that out. So fascinating to hear his conversation. And I think stay tuned, everyone, in terms of how things play out. But cities, I still love New York City.
Yeah.
I love it. There's
well, you and
like
Bruce
it.
Flatt, your long cities, your long offices. So we'll see where that goes. Check that whole interview out on BloombergLive.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
In today's Bloomberg Business Week Economics, we want to look at the interesting and complicated and often problematic relationship between the Fed and asset bubbles. Great voice to have to talk about that. He put out some research. Joe Kalish is back with us. He is Chief Global Macro Strategist at Ned Davis Research, and he joins us on the phone from Sarasota, Florida. Joe, it is so good to have you back with us. How are you?
I'm doing well, Carol. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you back. And, you know, it's interesting. We've heard from the Fed a lot lately, Jay Powell a lot, and certainly various Fed governors. You dig into, first of all, kudos and thank you, because you give props to our own Mike McKee here at Bloomberg News. And the question that he asked Jay Powell at the last press conference, why don't we kick off there? What kind of intrigued you about that question?
I thought Michael really zeroed in on some really critical questions that the Fed is going to need to grapple with, I think, longer term, and what we as investors need to grapple with and policymakers need to deal with. And essentially, you know, Michael asked two things. One was on the question of asset bubbles and whether the Fed's policies were helping to promote that. And the second one was as a consequence, was the Fed therefore contributing to wealth inequality? There were a lot of questions at the press conference about income inequality, mm-hmm. but Michael focused on the wealth inequality aspect. So I think both of those were really important questions to ask. And essentially, the Fed chairman said they really didn't have much choice if they weren't hitting their goals in terms of maximum employment and price stability, that, you know, they were really couldn't be concerned with the level of asset prices. And he really kind of, sidestepped the whole question about, wealth inequality. But he also did, I think Michael was also asking about, financial stability. And,
right.
And I thought Chairman Powell's way of framing that was to go to the banks and say, well, the banks are much better capitalized, and that's true. But in other areas of the Fed's monetary policy report, they did flag some issues with households and businesses and non-bank financials. So he sort of put a little bit more of a positive spin on it than was in the actual report.
Well, it's tricky, and it gets to the heart of what we've been talking, Joe, so much about here at Bloomberg, and in light of the virus, to be quite honest, and also what happened in Minneapolis and the killing of George Floyd. And again, we're talking about inequalities, racism in America, and we're once again having that discussion of wealth creation versus income, and where we're seeing the gaps. And there's a lot and a wide gap in America when it comes to who has the wealth and who does not. And you certainly get into that. You know, lots of questions about the Fed and central banks, U.S. central banks, and their role in creating bubbles. Your point is, we can learn from the past, and I guess the past has shown us that the Fed doesn't necessarily think a lot about the bubbles they're creating.
Well, they may be aware of them, but I guess they feel there's not much they can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the most famous one was the so-called irrational exuberance speech that former Fed Chairman Greenspan gave in December 1996. And at that time, the NASDAQ was around 1,200 or so, and
yeah.
Eventually climbed to 5,000. So, I think the attitude on the part of the policymakers is that they really can't identify a bubble and they'll just deal with the aftermath. And we had a very similar situation
right.
in the 2000s with the housing bubble, and you know the Fed was very slow to react to that. And then they kind of let asset prices go here up until you know the COVID crisis, and just let stock prices continue to rise and without much concern.
To be fair, though, and you know, and I know you listen to Bloomberg, I mean, as we've had many discussions, for a long time, it felt like the Fed was the only game in town. And we've certainly seen relief come from the U.S. government, but the Fed was certainly looking at ways to calm the markets, you know, make it easy to make sure that money was flowing throughout the economy, especially in the early days of the crisis and the shutting down of the economy. And so, you know, is it fair to say that you at least you know, understand kind of what the Fed is thinking about and what it's watching and maybe what it kind of almost had no choice but to do and to make it and kind of set the path for potentially creating another bubble?
Well, the problem is they really didn't have a choice, because if they didn't do those things, things would be a whole lot worse.
Well, that's my point. That's my point. Exactly. That they didn't really have a choice, right?
They really didn't have a choice. They had to restore the functioning of the financial markets, number one, which I think they've done a pretty good job of doing that. And then because of the huge setback we've had in the economy, you're actually restoring some wealth can be helpful in terms
right.
of spending.
Right.
And that could help support the economy. So, you know, I'm not saying it's not necessary. But my point was, in that the financial markets basically have a green light to
yeah.
go where they want to go, and the Fed is not going to come in
and stop it.
And stop the party.
And pop right. it. Well, and I just got about 30 seconds here, Joe. So do you see a bubble and what that bubble might be at this point, just quickly?
So I think there's a limit on how much, the Treasury rates can go down here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we kind of explored where those lows were, not just in the U.S., but globally. And in terms of stock market valuations, I see those as more
yeah.
fairly priced. There's a measure I like to look at on a forward basis,
right.
looking at the to triple B bond yields, and we're close to zero today
mm-hmm.
on that equity risk premium. And we never went below that during the entire 2009 to 2020 bull
Which,
market.
That's great.
Are.
Yeah, that's great perspective. Joe, thank you so much. Nice to get some time with you on this Wednesday. Really appreciate it. Joe Kalish, he's Chief Global Macro Strategist at Ned Davis Research, joining us on the phone in Sarasota, Florida.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
In our weekly Bloomberg Green segment, we're going to take a look at the common traits that are often found in leaders who really, really move the needle when it comes to sustainability. So let's get right to that story. I feel like I love when we get to specifics. Emily Chasen is sustainability editor at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone once again in New York City. Emily, good to have you back with us. Tell us about this story. I'm just curious about, they said, okay, you're going to go talk to leaders and find out what's in common. Tell us how it came about and what you found out.
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me again, Kara. This is a really interesting topic right now because there's so much systemic change in the system right now. There's a pandemic, there's climate change, there's huge issues around inequality and social justice. And who are the types of leaders who can solve those problems and identify these issues sooner rather than later and pivot and make changes in that? So what we did, we talked to Russell Reynolds Association, which is a recruiter, and they have been looking at the traits of leaders at the companies that are sort of scoring the best on sustainability. That's companies like Unilever, companies like Hilton Hotels. They worked at the UN Global Compact to find those. And what they found was there were some traits that sort of make a sustainability leader and some traits they might be born with.
I have to just say, just kind of a call out and maybe
yeah.
a little flex for Jason and me, but we have talked to both the head of Hilton, Chris Nassetta, and Alan Jope of Unilever. So we have talked with
in
them
like
directly.
In like the last month.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So tell us a little bit more about what those traits are.
Yeah, so well, the first one they found was being a multi-level systems thinker and being able to incorporate systems thinking into your your leadership style, right? And then there were also people who wanted to actively include stakeholders in their talks and really, you know, understand the issues of stakeholders and bring them in, not managing them, not telling them what to do, but to bring them in and bring them along. The other one was disruptive innovation and being able to challenge traditional approaches and cut through bureaucracy and sort of figure out where those trade-offs are between profitability and sustainability. And the last one was having sort of a long-term mindset. So they found these four ideas, and it wasn't necessarily that leaders were born with them. A lot of times maybe they were, but sometimes they'd wake up to them across the course of their career. Like they'd go through a transformative business opportunity and say, oh my gosh, wait, I can think differently about this.
Yeah, I mean, and man, as you said, we are seeing this so across the board right now in this moment, right? I mean, in this moment where a CEO isn't allowed to, or I shouldn't say it is allowed, isn't able to just like jet around the world and sort of hop from place to place. They're usually in one spot. They're having to deal with everything that's in front of them. And one of those things, obviously, are these big issues of equality, which demand a level of accountability and transparency that we just have not seen leaders subjected to in a long time, if ever, Carol.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And there's another story in the terminal. And Emily, I don't know if you saw this too, but it talked about ESG investors, those who run ESG funds, you know, and they're constantly saying to other companies and leaders like, hey, where's your diversity? Where's your sustainability? And now they're looking at their own firms and finding out, oh, wait, we're not doing so well on that mark. It's just kind of, you know, kind of blows your mind. And it's great that I think people are finally really understanding what it means to be either diverse or sustainable. You know, it has to be all the way around.
Yeah, it's definitely important to be authentic in all of these things and sort of walk the walk in addition to talk the talk. So we also talked to the Carlyle Group, which is out with its impact report this week on what they've been doing. And we asked them about, you know, how are you seeing this in the real world? And they said that the management teams that really focus on where the world is going versus where it has been are the ones that are generating great financial performance.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, and I will say private equity in many ways, and Emily, you and I have talked about this before. We've been at some of the same conferences around investing. And, you know, the private equity firms, for all of the slings and arrows that they take in many ways, they seem to have kind of gotten religion around impact over the past few years. You know, you think about what KKR is doing, Carlyle, you mentioned, and others, you know, and not to mention the ones who are very focused specifically on this, like Generation, which I know Al Gore's shop, which you've spent some time with.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of them are focused on this right now. KKR actually had a deal this week on water. There's a lot of thinking about this thing, you know, look at those long-term trends. We want to tap into them right now, especially in private equity, and especially in finding those leaders who can make the pivots necessary to build the infrastructure of the future.
Well, and not for nothing, but what the reason the private equity guys have gotten religion around this, as you well know, Emily, is because they can make a lot of money, and these executives that they can attract can make a lot of money. And so, you know, not surprisingly, Hilton, you know, not necessarily a sustainability play or an impact play, but private equity back. So really interesting. All right, Emily Chasen, thank you so much. Good to catch up with you, our sustainability editor for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from New York City. Sustainable leaders have these traits in common. Check that out on the Bloomberg or Bloomberg.com.
Pretty interesting, right?
Yeah, totally interesting.
But I think, you know, you and I have talked about too about everybody, okay, let's do another focus group. Let's talk about the problem, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, this is getting down to, okay, what makes a leader a really great leader in creating a diverse workforce, a diverse supply chain? Like, let's get down to the specifics.
Like doing
how do you
stuff.
Do it?
That's it. That's what creates it, doing stuff.
There's our next t-shirt, doing
yeah.
stuff.
Doing stuff.
Doing
yeah.
stuff.
Just do it. Just do good stuff. I had a boss a long time ago who said, just do good stuff. He didn't give any direction other than that, but that's what we went and did.
But it was a pretty clear message.
Yeah.
Just going to say.
Seems like it makes sense.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week on this Wednesday. Carol Masser along with Jason Kelly. It is time to count you down to the closing bell. Aaron Kennan is back with us. He's co-founder and chief executive officer at Clear Harbor Asset Management. Back with us once again on the phone from Greenwich, Connecticut. Aaron, good to have you here with us. You know, we've been talking with you certainly throughout the year and throughout this crisis. I don't know, how has your outlook on the markets, on the economic rebound, maybe changed over the last few months?
Well, great to be back, Carol. Thank you. Well, let's see. I mean, certainly we are going through a period where there's this huge divergence, right, between the equity markets and the real economy. Mm. Now, that's not necessarily a new thing, but the degree to which we're seeing a divergence is quite significant, meaning that, you know, the equity market tends to be a discounting mechanism. It tends to recover or start to recover ahead of a recovery in the real economy. But, you know, to come 39%, not including today, mm-hmm. you know, off of that March 23rd low is quite significant. I think there's a lot of optimism built in the equity markets. And when we, you know, sort of look at the divergence even within the equity market, I think it really details a tale of two stories. The technology piece is in a bull market, and the financial piece is very much in a bear market. And I think that's really sort of proven itself out, maybe perhaps since we last spoke.
And so where does it go from here, do you think, Aaron?
Well, I think as we wade through this crisis, it's going to be long. There are going to be a lot of speed bumps, Jason. And I believe that, you know, the technology sector is an asset-light sector that's focused on providing productivity to their clients, to their corporations. In this period of future deglobalization, where you're going to have supply chains moving all around the world, technology is going to play a key role in that effort. I think companies with strong balance sheets, with strong management and strong capital allocators more generally, are going to capture some market share during this crisis. They have been capturing market share during this crisis and will be even stronger as we come out the other side. So I think that trend continues. And the real question in our minds at Clear Harbor is, well, what about valuations? And technology valuations have become, you know, quite lofty across the board. And but, you know, you look at the banks and they're in a bear market. Net interest margins are collapsing. Loan growth is certainly a problem, and the credit picture is being buttressed by the Fed. So, yeah, go ahead, Karen.
No, you know what I was thinking, Aaron, though, listening to you, what you said about technology, and I certainly agree with you, but I got to say, I look at my world, and increasingly, I mean, Jason and I are doing our radio show because of technology, and everybody is working at home because of technology, and I feel like despite what the outlook is, if there's any one consistent theme that we can count on, and I know it's been what's propelled the markets higher, you know, coming off the crisis, but it is technology.
Absolutely. So I would be in complete agreement with that. And I think, you know, we do have points of concern across the economy. I mean, certainly if you look at the S&P 500 as in its entirety trading at, you know, pick your number, but it probably best case 24 times 2021 earnings, you know, that's a lofty multiple. Corporate debt loads are high. We saw that, you know, record high yield issuance this month. You know, that's all very much supported by Fed policy around the fallen angels. Unemployment, I think, is a huge question mark. And I've been hearing a lot about the rise in the savings rate. It's at a record. I don't think we saw a savings rate spike like this in our entire lifetime.
Right.
And some view that as a positive, that there's cash on the sidelines.
Well, you know, can I just jump? Because Jason and I talked about this yesterday. Oh, you know, okay. As our reporting, Ben Steverman put out a story that, you know, yay that Americans have some money on the sidelines, but there is still consistently, you know, research showing that most Americans out there don't even have enough money to deal with, like, a car bill of $400. Like, that money on the sidelines, some people are going to have to live on that. And I know...
Well, that's right. That's absolutely right. And the money on the sidelines is it an indication of optimism or is it an indication of anxiety?
Right.
And what will be the catalyst for altering that anxiety level?
Yeah. And so, you know, you mentioned the Fed, Aaron, and I feel like history will be very kind. I've said this on this program before to Jay Powell and his cohorts for what they have done. Don't fight the Fed, obviously, has been one of the mantras that we've heard over and over again from both institutional and individual investors. What do you think the Fed can and should do next, or what can we expect them to do next?
Well, I think they're going to continue to provide, you know, call it stimulus, monetary growth for as far as the eye can see. And I think the fiscal side, particularly heading into a presidential election, will do the same. So expect another fiscal stimulus package 4.0 coming along next month. But I also think the Fed is stuck because they're trying to weaken the dollar. They would never say that, but they are. But the world is faced with this COVID crisis. It's not just a U.S. economic slowdown.
Right.
And so it's difficult, you know, for the U.S. dollar to, you know, which is a flight to quality currency along with the yen, to depreciate here in the midst of this global uncertainty. And I think that's one point of real frustration for the Fed right now.
Do you think the Fed's creating another bubble? And this just piggybacks on a conversation that we had with Joe Kalish earlier at Ned Davis Research. And, you know, the Fed doesn't, you know, they're doing what they can to help out this economy, but as a result, maybe not so concerned about bubbles. They haven't been in the past. Do we need to be concerned about that, Aaron?
Well, I mean, I think the Fed is caught between a rock and a hard place. Certainly they're creating some bubbles. Some are maybe identifiable now, and some will be identifiable later, but that isn't to say that the Fed policy to try to sort of keep this economy afloat, which was sort of a government-induced initiative to close down the economy, is not warranted. I mean, I think the Fed is in a very difficult position, but they have a lot of firepower, and I think they'll continue to provide liquidity, and will liquidity to allow for insolvency rates to decline? I think that's a big question, and only time will tell on that.
All right. Aaron Kennan, thank you so much. We're going to leave it there. Co-founder, CEO of Clear Harbor Asset Management, joining us on the phone from Greenwich. Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.